Surely the drones make us worry. We know they have special targets, but we have also seen civilians being targeted too. When we hear them flying, we get scared, especially the children.
Back in 2017, the Trump administration replaced old guidelines with a looser set of rules for drone engagement that led to a 330% rise in civilian casualties in Afghanistan. A research by an independent media organization shows that from 2015 to 2020 alone, between 300 to 900 civilians lost their lives to U.S. drone operations. Experts say that even with the new policy adopted, U.S. drones in Afghanistan are still dangerous.
The U.S. government, according to its hegemonic dominance worldwide, is always after fulfilling their national interests. If their national interests require it, drone attacks could take place anyway. According to the policy, the attack permit only goes to a higher authority rather than commanders. Biden would sign the attack permit.
The aforementioned policy requires near certainty that a target is a member of a designated terrorist group and near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured before pulling the trigger. But it still remains unclear what this near certainty standard means in practice. The precision of U.S. drone attacks in Afghanistan has always been under question. There have been many examples of misguided U.S. strikes. Notably, an attack just before the withdrawal of U.S. forces last year that killed 10 members of a family. People here are still concerned that they might be the next target. Abdullah Hamirzadeh, Kabul.
I'm heading with Donbass militia fighters to a frontline position outside the city of Donetsk. Ukrainian soldiers are only 70 meters away. I'm told not to film the skyline or any prominent markers so as not to give away their positions. The cramped living quarters are dark and dank. A fighter with the call sign Yidra, meaning the otter, gives me a tour.
We live here not in trenches but under concrete. These are destroyed buildings that we've old basements. It is all dug out by hands, down the narrow passageways and understand what it's like to be a miner. We live here, breathe this air. You can't survive artillery any other way. At least you can hide from snipers, but not from artillery. Big caliber artillery, too.
He shows me a picture sent to him by his daughter. I asked him what has motivated him to fight in these conditions for the last 8 years.
Because this is where I live. My mother lives 25 kilometers from here. I speak Russian. My mom and dad speak Russian. I was a miner here. It's my land.
A young fighter, barely 18. The grueling nature of this war is bringing a seamlessly endless wave of young men on both sides to fight. A motivational poster, it reads, Donbass was never made to kneel by anybody, and nobody will be able to do it.
We understand that the USA are ruling this circus. Europe needs to stop being their vassals. America doesn't care about others. Their only way is to be at war. And they build their domestic policy out of conflicts with other countries. In Syria, they played the card of radical Islam, and now they're playing the card of fascism. They need war's blood and cruelty, and they signed Europe up to it too. They missed only one thing, that Russia will not stop fighting.
While there is raging ethnic hatred of Russians in Ukraine, after interviewing dozens of soldiers and civilians in Donbass, despite the war, I've yet to hear any ethnic hatred of Ukrainians.
We don't blame all Ukrainian people. Ukrainian people are our friends and relatives. Those who study this understand that one-third of Europe are cousins. Ukrainians, Belarusians, Slovaks, Poles, and Slovenians. They're all Slovak people. Ordinary people are not to blame for this. We think they're just corrupted by evil.
Out many Ukrainians who want peace negotiations with Russia, but are scared to speak up. Indeed, President Zelensky was elected in 2019 of war in the East. But the sad truth is set to escalate further. Peace in Ukraine has never looked less likely than it does now. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Linked hand in hand, thousands of men and women surround the British Houses of Parliament, a symbolic act in solidarity with a man they call the world's foremost political prisoner.
Is obvious for any observer, for anyone who is fairly looking at this situation, that this is an enormous, monumental injustice of a man who is being persecuted by the authorities, who are using the coercive powers of the state in order to try to punish him for doing the right thing.
That right thing was exposing American crimes and conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, for which he is wanted by the U.S. government. The now 51-year-old Australian, co-founder of whistleblower website WikiLeaks, has been locked up in a maximum security prison near London since April 2019.
To his many supporters, Julian Assange is an anti-establishment hero who's been victimized, and that his prosecution is a politically motivated assault on journalism and on free speech.
Organized by the Don't Extradite Julian Assange campaign, the human chain is not just about securing one man's freedom.
This has implications for pretty much every journalist who publishes material critical of the United States. If he is actually extradited and they succeed, then any other journalist in the UK or from around the world could face the same fate as Julian Assange, which would, of course, would be a strong discouragement to them to publish any critical material, and we get something like a chilling effect, basically, whereby the press ceases to scrutinize foreign policy of the most powerful nation on the planet.
And that powerful nation, under the Trump administration, it was revealed last year, plotted to kidnap or kill Assange as he sheltered in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Earlier this year, the UK government approved the father of two's extradition to the United States to face criminal charges which carry a maximum sentence of 175 years. An appeal to the UK's High Court is underway. Assange's supporters say they won't relent until he is unchained. Sai Purza, London.
People have rallied across the Yemeni capital Sana'a as well as other major cities to celebrate Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary amid the highly alarming situation in Yemen. This comes days after the warring sides failed to renew a ceasefire agreement which ended earlier in October.
The relationship between the Yemeni people and Prophet, it is narrated in history books as well as the holy book Quran. Yemenis are the first to embrace Islam, old relationship. The anniversary of Prophet Muhammad's birth has become a holiday for all Yemenis. There is no single about this gathering.
Participants say they celebrate Prophet Muhammad's values and principles by honoring his birth anniversary, especially amid the Saudi-led war, which requires Yemenis to follow the Prophet's footsteps in the face of the coalition's tyranny.
The occasion of the Prophet's birth anniversary becomes more important year after year. It has become the first occasion and the first aid for Yemenis, although it's an occasion that all Muslims celebrate. Unfortunately, only Yemenis celebrate this occasion with this beautiful gathering.
This day is an annual event in which Yemenis renew their relationship with Prophet Muhammad and their love for the Prophet, as he inspires us to confront the enemies of the nation. Today is also a political occasion from which the position of Yemenis is announced by the leader of the revolution, Abdul Malik al-Houthi.
Yemenis have always been one of the largest populations in the world to commemorate Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary, as this day resembles their culture, which approves their love and loyalty to the Prophet.
The Iranology Foundation in Tehran hosted this conference to introduce Iran from the perspective of Iranian experts, as opposed to Western accounts of the country's culture and civilization. The biennial event brought together historians, anthropologists, and sociologists, aspects of Iran's culture.
The Iranology Foundation has been trying to introduce Iran as it is to the world, organized summits and conferences on Iran's story to study the country from the viewpoint of Iranian. Here we have permanent galleries showcasing Iran's handicraft and art. We also hold classes for students who are major in Iranology.
Iran is known for its diverse demographic makeup, which has allowed Persians, Turks, Kurds, Baluchis, and Arabs to live together for centuries, each with their unique culture, costumes, language, and lifestyle.
The West's approach on Iran is not based on realities. The so-called Orientologists in the West have maintained a top-down approach toward Iran. Fortunately, today this mentality has been abolished. Our country is full of beauties, from its four seasonal weather and amazing landscapes to its history of peaceful coexistence of different ethnicities and religions. These are the realities that are not reflected in the West.
With a population of more than 80 million, Iran is situated on a geopolitical area, bordering the Caspian Sea to its north and the Persian Gulf to its part of what experts refer to as the heartland of natural resources, including those to exploitation by different countries, the UK and the former Soviet Union. Experts here believe Western media portray Iran as an isolated country and ignore its beauties. They believe there's a need to reintroduce the country to the world using the pen of Iranian experts to shed light on the bright side of Iran, from its mesmerizing nature to its rich culture and history. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
New jobs data in the United States showed a collapse of 1.1 million job openings, the biggest one-month crash ever outside of the COVID lockdown. It's also the first increase in the unemployment rate since April 2020, and that has many so-called recession deniers being forced to reconsider. The United States has had two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth, which is the standard definition of economic recession. However, in an effort to avoid the negative press the recession label receives, the administration of President Joe Biden claimed that a stable unemployment rate meant that the U.S. was not in a recession. That's no longer possible. Due to the so-called Uberization of the United States economy, the official data has long been accused of falsely portraying a rosy picture. The national unemployment rate is 4%, but many say the jobs available are part-time or lack crucial benefits like health care, or are poorly paid despite the current record inflation.
People looking for benefits, they want to work from home. People are not settling like they used to. It's just a matter of, I don't want to say laziness, but I think people are just, they're trying to get the best that they want, and companies are trying to hold steady and their wages, and they're not willing to pay as much because costs are going up for them as well.
Amid the backfiring of Western sanctions on Russia, many businesses have responded by cutting job listings, slowing the hiring process, and may begin mass layoffs. The widespread perception is that America's central bank is forcing a recession to reduce inflation, even if that means throwing millions out of work, out of their homes, and guts pensions, which are usually based on the stock market. The drop in jobs is the latest piece of data which shows a dangerously worsening economic situation for the average American. Wages are losing ground to inflation at a record pace, and an economically chaotic October could translate into a painful holiday season for many. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The night chaos and violence came to England's Islamic Center as marauding crowds, intent on raising more than their voices, lay siege to the usually peaceful premises. More than a week later, there is still evidence of the violence that boiled over. Amongst the victims that night was a longtime Quran teacher at the center who was set upon by a baying mob.
Suddenly the people, so many people were sitting there standing, started calling me and swearing and shouting, stay, and surrounded me. And the other people came, starting hitting me, kicking me, and swearing, just without stopping. And I couldn't understand. I was so surprised from them. So how can the people become this violent? One of them, he kicked me from the over my kidney, and I still have a problem with my kidney. I went to the hospital, so the doctor, my knee as well, so it just had very big scratch in my knees and bleeding. I still have problems with my leg, right leg, and I can't walk properly after 10 days, more than 10 days.
Said Mousavi is the director of the center and is leading the charge for justice.
The Islamic Center is following its legal path, and a case against the riots has been filed, and it is ongoing based on document and evidence.
Days after violence rocked the Islamic Center, there is still a visible police presence. And whilst those inside do everything they can to protect themselves and their loved ones, it's hoped that should there be a repeat of this atrocity, the authorities will do more.
Until those responsible are brought to account, there are still questions.
But why they did that in that time, I was so surprised. I think it wasn't only one group. I think it was very small groups of the people who were against Islam and against the humanity, against the kindness, I think they were like this, some of them.
There is now a call for calm and dialogue as the only paths forward.
If you want people listen to you and respect your idea, you should respect the idea of the other as well. That is why I want to ask them, please come and talk and have a dialogue with each other. And then with the dialogue, we can listen to different ideas. And of course, even in Quran, we have a specific advice that tells us you should listen to different words and choose the best. But different word, not different attack.
Meanwhile, the Metropolitan Police is continuing its identification of individuals responsible for the anti-Iran violence that spilled over on British streets. Amina Taylor, London.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to sanctions, Iran has been a target of Western countries for quite some time, especially the U.S. And now with the most recent protests, which consists of foreign-backed riots, sanctions are raining down on Iran, from Canada's sanctions on Iran's press TV to the IRGC members, to the U.S. and U.K. sanctioning of Iran's police. We ask, does the U.K., or Western countries have the ground to stand on when it comes to human rights or the right to impose sanctions when they are guilty of human rights violations in their own country? And don't their sanctions constitute interference in other countries' affairs? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. He joins us. He's a political analyst from London. Also joining us is Hafsa Kara Mustafa, journalist and political commentator, who also joins us from London.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'd like to first start with you, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, if I may, and ask you about the UK sanctions, where they have sanctioned Iran's police. And at this point, the quick question that comes about is, does the UK really have a leg to stand on when it comes to the issue of human rights, of which it is basing its sanctions on?
Well, certainly not at a time where Julian Assange is rotting in prison, facing what no one really understands what charges, since the charges from the Swedish lady who initially pressed charges against him have been dropped. And obviously he's been maintained in solitary confinement, which is actually a violation of basic human rights. So just on that element alone, I think Britain doesn't have a leg to stand on. But of course, there are so many other details. For instance, war crimes committed by British soldiers, whether in Iraq or Afghanistan, in the way they were treating civilians. So of course, Britain has no leg to stand on. But we're used to seeing Western nations actually lecturing other countries on human rights and on issues such as these, whilst at home or for their own, actually never respecting those very basic human rights that they feel others should abide by.
Sure, Brisby, taking a look at the EU, they have issued a resolution against Iran, and I need to just get justifications from you, and that's why I'm reading off some of the countries or organizations that have leveled sanctions, and in this case, resolution, where it said the resolution criticizes the necessary countermeasures that Iran has taken against the organized acts of violence. Why does the EU feel that it has to come into the picture as a whole and issue a resolution against Iran?
Hello, good evening, Kavi. Obviously, we saw recently one of the Swedish MEP in Brussels cutting her hair. So tonight, I'll be cutting the tie to show that this is the symbol of oppression, which everyone should take off their ties if they want to be part of the resistance movement. Now, coming back to your question, why EU at this time? As our fellow colleague from London quite rightly pointed out, that not only there's hypocrisy and double standards on part of the Britain, but the whole of the European Union, from tiny countries like Lithuania, Estonia, and others in the Baltic and other countries in Europe, they quite often work in cahoots with Washington to put pressure on Iran. As you can remember, even Iran is the country for the last 42 years, the West has been at war with Iran in one form or another, whether it was the eight-year war inflicted on Iran via Saddam in Iraq, or sanctions being applied, or nuclear scientists being assassinated, all kinds of conspiracies and intrigue has been created for the last 42 years. If there were any other nation other than Iran, it would have succumbed by now. The only reason why all these measures are being applied to Iran is that because it does not support the Zionist entity in West Asia. Tomorrow, if the government and the leadership in Iran decides to recognize Israel, then hunky-dory, there is no human rights issue. There are no problems with Iran. Iran would be in the good books of the West. Uh-huh. So the reality is that it's the support for the Palestinians and being part of the resistance and really not recognizing the Zionist state that has created the problem for Iran for the last 42 years. Not pitifully of the death of this particular young lady. That just a decoy to hoodwink the world into thinking that West is on the side of the human rights.
Sympathize strongly with the passing away of the woman is what Iran's president has said. Iran's leader has said that also, that it was a sad thing, Hafsatar Mustafa. But this is the statement that we continue to hear. We will continue to work with our partners to hold Iranian officials accountable for gross human rights violations. Keep hearing that over and over again, and mostly this comes from the U.S. Is this a line by the U.S. to tell its partners that you should go with the line that we're telling you or asking you so we can all appear as a united front against Iran? Is that what it's trying to do here?
Well, I think at this particular moment in time, I think what the EU and America are trying to do is push Iran in a corner because it's a major gas producer, and they want to make sure that Iran will succumb and will adhere to whatever conditions that are imposed by Western powers when it comes to trading with Iran. So push it in a corner in order for Iran to then be far more compliant. I'd have to say, it's not just about Israel, because the Shah was actually recognized Israel, and at the last minute he was dropped by the West. So Israel is inevitably an element of why the West is constantly against Iran, but it's also a way of maintaining it is a resistance country that hasn't complied in any way to any Western pressure, but it's also the way of keeping pressure because it's a major oil and gas producer, and therefore it's a way of making sure that when you play hot and cold with a country like Iran, you can manage to force it to comply, which it doesn't. Just can I just add also that just before the COVID pandemic started, for instance, France had faced major human rights violation issues when it shot and when it maimed scores and hundreds of protesters during the Yellow Vest movement that lasted almost a year, and no sanctions were ever imposed on it, despite major evidence that the police were literally shooting to maim the protesters. So we can see constantly the double standards when it comes to countries such as Iran. And of course, it is basically designed to weaken these countries and to force them to accept whatever terms and conditions is imposed on them in order to allow them to trade more easily.
Iran has come out and said that the internal issue of the Islamic Republic is related to the government and the nation of Iran. Shabir Rizvi, we will not allow any country to interfere in the internal affairs of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Where do you think that line was crossed when it came to the reaction by, let's say, the UK or the US or the EU or Germany for that matter?
Well, as I said, the line was crossed when the advent of the Islamic Revolution occurred back 42 years ago. Since then, there have been all kinds of maneuvers that have been used by the West to continuously try to weaken Iran. But the reality is that no matter what methods they use, no matter what sort of technology, I mean, recently, the cyber attacks that have been taking place in Iran is another aspect, plus the use of the social media that is occurring to ignite certain elements of the public to come out on the streets. And the reality is that, like the sister said, that, you know, what happened in France with the Yellow Vest. But the reality is that if you look at the USA, I think the latest figure before coming on to this interview I was looking at, during this year, 1,117 people have been killed in police custody in the USA. So really, you know, how does America and the West have any leg to stand on when they talk about brutality by the Iranian government, when they are not only brutal and commit atrocities on other countries, but they also do the same to their own people if they're standing against, you know. And the thing is, the demonstrations that take place in the West are not really to change the government, not to change the political system. People are usually asking for their basic rights. For instance, over the weekend in UK, there were demonstrations up and down the country in support of, against cost of living, the price of energy. And again, over the weekend, there were demonstrations in Germany, in Holland, in Italy, all over the place, with the cost of living crisis that is facing the West. So when there are demonstrations just for basic needs, those demonstrators are, in a way, beaten up, and all kinds of issues are used. I just want to remind your audience and sort of recap back here in 10 years ago, there were demonstrations in London virtually over the weekend in many, many cities. What happened at that time, hundreds and thousands of people were arrested and got a criminal record. The courts sort of sat overnight to send people into prison. It was a riotous situation. And again, people were demanding, basic rights, not demanding the change of government. If, for example, if the demonstrators did come out in Paris, London, or New York demanding the change of government, then I can see very easily when people were killed at Kent University 60 years ago, demonstrating against Vietnam War. So there's a whole litany of human rights abuses by the West in their own countries against their own people for decades.
Okay, Shabir Rizvi, Hafsakar Mustafa mentions how the media encourages, Shabir Rizvi, correct me if I'm wrong, for people to come out and protest. And usually when they do that, in many instances, if not almost all instances, they are putting that in the context of a video where people are actually vandalizing or setting something on fire. So that's, in a sense, encouraging to incite violence. Now, at the same time, we are looking at the double standards at play here, which I'm trying to understand how they think they can get away with it when you have, for example, what happened in the protests in London a few weeks back at the Iranian embassy, where protesters, many of them were Iranians, actually clashed with the police in London. Then the Met said, we got to go after them. These people, because some got away, I guess. The Iranians, that is. And there was some pictures that were plastered, kind of like a manhunt. I'm not too sure if they got him yet or not. That approach is okay for London, but not in Iran. In Iran, come out, protest, violence, etc. What do you think about the way that the UK is displaying itself there?
Well, again, I mean, it's been very hypocritical, but it always is. Just to pick up on the other panelists' point, again, there were in 2010, in the harsh winter, which was one of the coldest winters on record, students came out to protest against tuition fees, and the police introduced a method called kettling, which meant that they were kept standing still for 6-7 hours in -4 degrees temperatures, and they couldn't move. And those who tried to move were arrested and were given exemplary sentences up to 4 years for simply attempting to leave the ring and to leave this sort of kettling method. So the brutality, police brutality, whenever anyone takes to the street to protest, even for basic things such as banning tuition fees, is actually repressed in the most violent ways. And yet here you have people actually encouraging Iranians to go out and to break and to commit violent crimes, which is, again, I mean, the hypocrisy is staggering, but we're so used to it. I think people have just become accustomed to it and no longer know what to say. But I think public opinion is not as on board as it used to be. I'd love to say that overall people are seeing through the propaganda, Western propaganda. They're not. But many do realize that there is a double standard. Many have also pointed out the fact that in France, women, for instance, are not allowed to wear the hijab, and no one said anything about the basic human rights of these women. When you see French women sort of cutting their hair as a symbol to support the Iranian women, knowing, can I add, that the current Home Secretary, the Interior Minister of France, has been accused by 4 different women of rape. So when a French woman goes to the police station to complain that she's been a victim of a sexual assault, the boss of the police officers has actually himself been accused of rape by 4 different women. So this is the absolute comical scenario, had it not had such dangerous consequences, that we're currently living. We're living in times of absurdity, and no one can see through it.
Well, the thing that is very alarming here is the way that the approach is being used by certain governments, which is now somewhat coming to light that there may be political, perhaps, intentions. This is another side to this whole saga, if you may call it, Shabir Rizvi, where you've had certain politicians come out and say, I believe it was the UK Foreign Secretary that came out and said this, that Iran should behave, Iran should not deal with the protests violently, because if it wants, for example, for there to be, and Iran should not go after the nuclear bomb, all within one context, alluding to the fact that Iran should stop this, and along with that, perhaps it might find a way for this JCPOA revival sanctions removal talks to happen, if you know what I'm getting at with this. So are we looking at governments trying to somewhat push Iran using the protest as a means to get back or to come into the deal that has been worked on for quite some time?
Well, look, if you want me to address the issue of JCPOA, I think that's not really quite fundamental. Whether the JCPOA comes to an agreement or not, that's not an issue. But I think whether it's the UK Foreign Secretary, Mr. Cleverly, or any other Western leader, whenever they get on their pulpit and start preaching to a nation like Iran on human rights abuse, on XYZ, I think they should really look closer home and really try to sort of implement policies which would be in favor of the ordinary people here. You know, our previous Home Secretary, Priti Patel, passed legislation where even demonstrating would become illegal in the UK. And the current Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, is even sort of extraordinary trying to implement policies of all kinds, whereby they want to send people coming to UK as asylum seekers to Rwanda. So all kinds of different human rights abuses are taking place in the United Kingdom and most of the European countries. So really, at the end of the day, I think all the nations, all the sort of Western nations, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, European Union, and USA really should analyze what they are doing themselves. But I dare say, because the reality is that they feel that they are right, they have the arrogance to continue on the same policy, and really they suffer from hubris, to use a phrase which is often used to describe this kind of a situation, when the people who continually speak a lie start believing that lie and think that they are taking the right path. But the reality is that, as our other guest speaker was saying, that I think at least some people, even in the West, are realizing the hypocrisy of their own governments. And I think the cost of living crisis and what's happening with Ukraine will perhaps remove the veils from the eyes of the people, right, who still feel that the West is always right.
I'm going to reflect on a statement made by a former CIA official, Hafsah Mustafa, if I may, to get your reaction on this, because this relates to what Iran's leader has said, where Bruce Riddell, who was a former CIA official, said, "There's little doubt that there is a covert war that's underway against Iran, and there are at least two players in it. It's the U.S. and the Israel." How much do you think that this statement made by the Bruce Riddell actually applies maybe to what is going on here? Because we know, obviously, in terms of Israel and also in terms of the U.S., this has been going on for quite some time against Iran.
I mean, surprisingly honest coming from a CIA source. But again, I mean, if it's a CIA, he obviously knows what he's talking about. And it's true. Since the Iranian Revolution back in 1979, Iran has been in the firing line of both America and Israel. And it's the only country that has been consistently opposed to any normalization with Israel, has closed the former Israeli embassy, replaced it with a Palestinian embassy. So it's constantly inflicting humiliation upon humiliation, on Israel. And Israel is not accepting this lightly. So, you know, the more Iran resists, the more Israel will apply pressure. And unfortunately, of course, as with many other countries, you have, what Malcolm X refers to as the house slaves, the people who actually are within, inside, and who serve foreign interests. And I think that could be a danger for Iran. But of course, I think that when push comes to shove, Iranians have always showed to rally amongst each other and in support of their government, and always rally against foreign enemies because they know that they're a target. And therefore, even though I think things look worrying at this very moment, if anything, I suspect that when the worst comes to pass, actually Iran will come out of this stronger. And it will come out of this stronger. Why? Because, of course, Europe is about to face a wave of civil unrest over the cost of living crisis. And I think, ironically, it will be the opportunity for many Iranian Twitters and people on social media to then encourage their Western counterparts to do what they're currently doing to Iranian protesters.
Well, here's a good point. And this is really sad, but the differentiation needs to be mentioned again, Shebi Rizvi, and that is the fact that if you had, which I'm sure there were people who were protesting when this protest first broke out, that even though it was not related in their eyes when they came out to protest to the unfortunate death of that young woman, but they were protesting because they were perhaps economically were not privileged. They had financial, perhaps, gripes that were plaguing their daily lives. But this protest got stolen once violence kicked in, and once there was rioting, and once there were destruction of property, of which that particular sect of the protesters, that's not what they obviously wanted to promote, to have their voices heard. How do you think, I mean, this was speculation maybe, but how do you think that happened, where that division all of a sudden appeared, and then the ones that were protesting peacefully went out of the picture, and now it's just people who want to vandalize, in a sense. Not all of them still, but a majority of them.
Well, look, at the end of the day, in every country, there are economic issues. And particularly with Iran, when it has been sanctioned for the last 42 years, there will, of course, be issues which would affect a significant number of people. But there are ways of protesting. And also, as President Rouhani has quite rightly pointed out, that demonstrations are permitted in Iran. But violence of this type, killing of the policemen, destruction of property, burning of police cars in any country, this will not be acceptable. So why should it be acceptable in Iran? But also you must remember, Kaveh, is that quite often there is a particular segment in each city, whether it's in London, New York, or Washington, or Tehran. There's a richer part of a city and perhaps not that well off. Of course, the richer part of any city are not the barometer of any nation. For example, in London, if you came and asked someone living in Hampstead or Kensington about cost of living crisis, they will have no idea. Similarly, in Iran, if someone living in sort of expensive parts of Tehran will not understand that.
Thank you. I'm sorry we're first out of time. Do appreciate that, though. Shabir Rizvi, political analyst. Hazakar Mustafa, pleasure. Journalist and political commentator, both from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikael Tarvay and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we briefly spoke about Imam Khomeini's first days in Nofello Chateau, a village around Paris, and the way his family, especially his wife, Ms. Sarafi, would handle the affairs in that village. Today we are going to continue the story. Stay with us, please. As we had said earlier, the Shah of Iran fled the country on January 16, 1979, and arrived in Aswan of Egypt. The news of his escape soon reached Paris, making Imam Khomeini's companions and many of the foreign journalists happy. Everyone was waiting for the Imam's reaction, but he only said, "Well," and there was no change in his face. The four-month period of Imam Khomeini's stay in France was a good opportunity to clarify and proclaim the Islamic Revolution's message to the world. Imam Khomeini used to make relations with religious people and arouse their sentiments in favor of the Iranian oppressed people. For instance, on the occasion of the new Gregorian year and the birthday of Prophet Jesus, the Imam sent a message to the Christians of the world and called Jesus as the reviver of the dead and the awakener of the sleep. He also called for the world Christians to pray for the Iranian nation. He wrote in his message, "I ask you, the Christian community, in your blessed days, to pray for our nation, which is caught by the unjust king, and appeal to God for their salvation. I ask you to warn the heads of some of the Christian countries who support the oppressive Shah with their satanic power and smash a nation under the pressure of oppression and make them familiar with the teachings of Prophet Jesus. I ask the Christian clergy to advise the heads of some of the powerful countries and denounce their support for those who have turned their back to the heavenly teachings." As Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, issued his message to the world Christians, his wife entered the scene of political activities more seriously. She says, "I had no specific duty in Nofelo Chateau until the Imam sent congratulatory message to the world Christians. As I was somehow aware of his Gnostic views, I felt it as a duty to elucidate the Imam's opinion so that some people would not think he had done a merely political job." Ms. Saqafi speaks about her life with Imam Khomeini. "In those days, I spent almost 100 hours in solitude and reviewed my life. I thank God more than 1,000 times for marrying a person whose thoughts are updated the older he becomes." As the Shah had escaped, the entire Iranian nation was waiting for the Imam's return to the country, but this decision faced many problems and obstacles. The Shah's premier was still in power and he might make problems for the Imam. Many of the politicians believed that the Imam's flight might be dangerous, while others maintained that he should return to the country as his presence among the people would accelerate the revolution's victory. Finally, Imam Khomeini made his mind to return to the country and Haj Ahmad made the preparations for his trip. Thus, one night, he told his companions in Nofelo Chateau, "Once again, I apologize to all and I will soon go to Iran. There is the possibility of some dangers in this trip. Thus, I don't want anyone be at risk for my sake. I and Ahmad will go. If we reach Iran with no problem, we will meet each other in Iran, God willing. And if there is a danger for me, you should be present to continue the struggle." One of the attendants said, "You mean that you are not intent to take ladies in this trip? Was there no woman with Imam Hussein?" The Imam answered, "Imam Hussein was Imam Hussein. I don't want to accompany the ladies. As for the men also, I said that I don't like anybody to be in trouble for me." Ms. Khadija Saqafi says that the night of Imam Khomeini's farewell was not that hard, as his face was full of faith in God. She says, "It was not hard because by seeing the Imam's face, I was sure that there would be no problem for him and his companions. I was sad that I couldn't accompany him, yet I knew that if I accompanied him in the plane and Tehran, his attention would partly be drawn toward me. So, I understood that if I do not accompany the Imam, he would be more comfortable and would not have any concern about me. However, I knew that his departure would make the village silent and gloomy, and I would be sad." Imam Khomeini and his companions landed at Mehrabad Airport in Tehran in the morning of February 2, 1979, and his wife and others joined him within 2 days. We will continue the story in the next episode.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.